Welcome to the deep dive. We take that stack of source material you've given us, and we really try to boil it down to the practical, need-to-know information.
Absolutely.
And today, we're tackling tuberculosis, TB, a topic that, honestly, a lot of people might think is kind of, well, a thing of the past, especially in developed countries.
Yeah, you'd think so, but it's really anything but historical, especially for anyone going into healthcare. Nursing students, take note. This is incredibly relevant.
Still a major player, then.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. TB is still the leading cause of death worldwide from a single infectious agent. It's staggering. We're talking about Mycobacterium tuberculosis.
Right.
This bug currently infects, or has at some point infected, something like a third of the entire global population.
A third. That's huge.
It's astronomical. And understanding how to manage it, I mean, it directly impacts safety in hospitals, clinics, everywhere, and shapes public health strategy.
Okay, so that's our goal today. This deep dive is really about getting a solid grip on the clinical side, how to spot it, manage it, the infection control nurses need to know inside out.
Exactly. It's mostly known for hitting the lungs, right? Pulmonary TB.
Yeah.
But its ability to spread, to go systemic, that's what makes it such a tough opponent.
So our mission here is to get past just the definition. We need the clinical details, like the difference between latent and active TB, how you diagnose it when someone's immune system is weak.
And crucially, the role of nursing in making sure treatment actually works long term. Adherence is everything with TB.
Let's jump right in then. Section one, transmission and high-risk environments.
Yeah.
For any healthcare worker listening, especially students learning the ropes, knowing how this spreads, it's step one.
It's absolutely fundamental. TB is airborne.
Period. Not touch, not surface.
Nope. Strictly airborne. It happens when someone with active TB in their lungs or larynx coughs, sneezes, laughs, shouts, even sings forcefully. They expel these minuscule droplets called droplet nuclei.
Droplet nuclei. Mm. Okay. And what makes those different, say, from flu droplets? Why the special precautions?
Size and weight. These particles are tiny, maybe 1 to 5 microns across, and they carry the mycobacteria. Because they're so light, they don't just drop to the ground. They can hang suspended in the air for hours.
Wow.
Yeah, long after the person who coughed has left the room. That's why regular droplet precautions aren't enough. We have to treat the air itself as potentially contaminated.
That really changes the game. Okay, so that sets up the question of who's most vulnerable. We know TB often hits vulnerable populations, but who specifically should raise a red flag for clinicians?
Well, you're looking mainly at two big areas.
Hmm?
Compromised immunity and socioeconomic factors. The biggest single risk factor, HIV infection. It dramatically increases the chance of TB progressing.
Okay.
But also other conditions that weaken immunity, patients on cancer chemo, organ transplant recipients, people with chronic kidney failure, those on long-term steroids, they're all at higher risk.
And you mentioned socioeconomic factors too.
Absolutely. You know, TB has often been called a disease of poverty or social injustice. And there's truth to that. Risk factors include poverty itself, inconsistent healthcare access, homelessness.
Crowded living conditions.
Definitely. Living or working in places like prisons, shelters, some long-term care facilities, or even certain densely populated inner city areas where TB might be more common.
And being foreign-born from a high-prevalence country is another key one for the intake history, right?
Crucial, yes. It's a standard screening question for a reason. We also need to think about exposure to multidrug-resistant organisms, MDROs, though that's more about treatment difficulty later.
Which leads us right to healthcare workers. We work in these institutional settings, sometimes doing procedures that, well, they increase risk.
Exactly. HDWs are inherently at higher risk just by being there, but certain procedures really up the ante. Anything that generates aerosols from respiratory secretions.
Like what specifically?
Think intubation, bronchoscopy, suctioning the airway, giving nebulizer treatments. These are high-risk procedures. They demand the highest level of protection.
Okay, so let's get practical. Prevention and infection control. You suspect active TB in a patient. What's the immediate protocol?
First step. Identify quickly and isolate immediately. That means getting the patient into an airborne infection isolation room or AII room.
The negative pressure room.
That's the one. These rooms are engineered, so air flows into the room from the hallway, and the air from the room is then filtered and exhausted directly outside or through special HEPA filters. It prevents contaminated air escaping into the general hospital environment.
That's the room itself. What about the staff going in with PPE?
Standard surgical masks, useless against these tiny droplet nuclei. You need high efficiency filtration. That means, at minimum, an N95 respirator mask.
Not just any N95 off the shelf.
Absolutely not. It must be fit tested for that specific individual to ensure a tight seal against their face. No gaps. If a proper fit can't be achieved, or for those really high-risk aerosol-generating procedures we talked about, then you escalate to a PAPR, a powered air purifying respirator. It's a hood or helmet with a battery-powered blower that forces filtered air in. Much higher protection factor.
That fit testing point is so important for students to grasp. It's not just ticking a box, it's your actual physical barrier.
It is non-negotiable. And beyond the individual patient, the facility needs a solid HCW surveillance program. Baseline TB testing when you're hired, regular screenings depending on risk level, and rigorous contact investigations if there's an exposure.
And if an HCW is exposed.
Then prophylactic therapy, usually with a drug like isoniazid, might be recommended to stop a latent infection from developing before it even starts.
Right, preventing it from taking hold. Okay, that's a strong defense system. Now we know how it spreads and how we protect ourselves. Let's shift gears slightly to section 2, pathophysiology and classification. What actually happens inside the body when those mycobacteria land?
Okay, so the journey starts deep in the lungs. Those tiny airborne droplets get inhaled, bypass the upper airways, and settle way down in the periphery, in the alveoli. That's ground zero.
And the bacteria just start multiplying.
Yeah, try to. The body's first responders, the macrophages, rush in and engulf the bacteria. Phagocytosis.
But TB bacteria are notoriously tough, aren't they? They can survive inside those macrophages?
They can, yeah. Their waxy cell wall gives them protection, so the immune system realizes, okay, we can't easily kill these guys, and it shifts strategy to containment. It tries to wall them off.
The granuloma formation.
Exactly. Other immune cells, lymphocytes, gather around the infected macrophages, forming this organized structure, a fibrous mass called a granuloma. Over time, the center can become necrotic, kind of cheesy, that's caseous necrosis.
And in the lungs, these granulomas plus affected lymph nodes are the GON complex we see on x-rays sometimes.
That's right. The GON focus is the primary lung lesion, and the GON complex includes the involved lymph nodes. It's a hallmark of the initial immune response trying to contain the infection.
But this attempt to wall it off,
does
it always succeed? Can the bacteria spread before containment?
Oh, yes. Before that granuloma fully forms and solidifies, the mycobacteria can hitch a ride through the lymphatic system or even enter the bloodstream.
So it's not just a lung disease then?
Not necessarily. This early spread is how TB can become extrapulmonary. It can set up shop in other organs, the meninges covering the brain and spinal cord, the kidneys, bones, especially the spine.
Pott's disease,
right. Or lymph nodes, causing scrofula. So while it starts in the lungs, it has the potential to go systemic.
This really brings us to that critical distinction, the two main states of TB infection that dictate everything clinically.
Yes.
Let's clearly define latent versus active TB.
Okay. Latent TB infection, or LTBI. This is where the immune system has successfully walled off the bacteria within those granulomas. The bacteria are alive, but dormant, inactive.
So the person feels fine.
Completely asymptomatic. And crucially, they are not infectious. They cannot spread TB to others.
But they are still infected.
Yes. The bacteria are still there, contained. You can think of it like a sleeping dragon. It's dormant. But it could wake up if the person's immune system weakens later in life.
Which is why we sometimes treat latent TB.
Right.
Right. To prevent that reactivation.
Exactly. We give prophylactic treatment to people with LTBI who are at high risk of it reactivating, like those with HIV, close contacts of an active case, or people starting immunosuppressant drugs. We want to kill the dormant bacteria before they get a chance to cause active disease.
Okay, so that's latent. What about active TB?
Active TB is the opposite. This is when the immune system's containment fails. The granuloma breaks down, the bacteria escape, and they start multiplying rapidly, causing tissue damage and symptoms.
And this is the contagious stage?
This is the contagious stage. This is the person who feels sick, cough, fever, night sweats, weight loss, and can spread the bacteria to others. Usually, active TB develops years after the initial infection, often when immunity declines. We call this reactivation TB or secondary TB.
But you mentioned earlier that sometimes it doesn't go latent first. Primary progressive TB.
Yes, that can happen. Usually in people with very weak immune systems, like young children or those with advanced HIV, their bodies just can't mount an effective initial containment response.
So the infection just takes off right away?
Pretty much. Soon after exposure, instead of becoming latent, it progresses directly into active, often widespread disease. It can be harder to spot initially and often more severe.
And that brings us to the most severe form. You mentioned miliary TB. What exactly is that?
Miliary TB is basically disseminated TB. It means the bacteria have spread widely throughout the body via the bloodstream.
Why miliary?
It comes from the appearance on imaging, particularly chest x-rays. You see countless tiny nodules like millet seeds scattered everywhere, lungs, liver, spleen, bone marrow. It signifies a massive, overwhelming infection, a true medical emergency with high mortality.
That really paints a picture of TB as this slow burn, often hiding, waiting for an opportunity, which makes recognizing it tricky. Let's move into section 3, clinical presentation and diagnostics. Yeah. How does active TB typically show up? What should nurses be looking for?
The big thing to remember is that it's usually chronic and insidious. It creeps up on you. Unlike, say, a typical bacterial pneumonia that hits you like a ton of bricks.
Right. High fever, sudden onset.
Exactly. TB symptoms develop slowly, often over weeks or even months. The classic signs are really systemic first. Things like profound fatigue, just feeling generally unwell, malaise.
Not wanting to eat.
Anorexia, yes. And significant unintentional weight loss is a big one. That's often what people notice first.
Yeah, the fever. Is it usually high?
Not typically. It's more often a persistent low-grade fever, maybe just slightly elevated, especially in the afternoons or evenings.
Okay. And the lung symptoms?
The cough is key. It usually starts dry and persistent, maybe just an annoying tickle. But over time, it often becomes productive, meaning they start coughing up sputum, which can be purulent, sometimes streaked with blood.
Hemoptysis,
yeah. And maybe the most classic symptom, the one that really screams TB, is drenching night sweats. Patients describe waking up soaked, having to change their sheets.
That cluster persistent cough, low fever, weight loss, night sweats, fatigue. That's the classic picture.
That's the textbook picture. But a really important point, especially for nurses working with diverse populations.
Yeah.
Atypical presentations are common.
How so?
Particularly in older adults. Their immune response might be blunted. They might not have the high fever or dramatic night sweats. Sometimes the only signs are subtle, maybe confusion, decreased appetite, just a general decline, what we sometimes call failure to thrive.
And they're at higher risk for bad outcomes, right?
Much higher mortality risk in the elderly. So you need a very high index of suspicion in older patients, even if the classic symptoms aren't all there. Also, initial presentation often doesn't include things like sharp chest pain or severe shortness of breath, unless there are complications.
Okay, so suspicion is high. What's the diagnostic pathway? How do we confirm it? We still use the skin test, the PPD?
We do, the tuberculin skin test, or MANTU test. But it's crucial to understand what it tells us and what it doesn't. It's primarily a test for exposure or latent infection, not necessarily active disease.
And it requires careful technique.
Very careful. It's an intradermal injection just under the skin, creating a small bleb. Then it has to be read correctly 48 to 72 hours later. You measure the induration, the hard raised bump, not just the redness.
What are the main problems with the PPD?
Two big ones. First, the BCG vaccine. It's a TB vaccine used in many parts of the world, but not routinely in the U.S. People who've had BCG can have a false positive PPD reaction.
Right, makes it hard to interpret.
And second, in people who are severely immunocompromised, think late stage AIDS, for example, their immune system might be too weak to react to the PPD antigens at all. They can have a false negative result even if they are infected. We call that anergy.
Which is why the blood tests are often preferred now, especially in certain groups.
Exactly. The interferon gamma release assays, or IgRAs tests, like Quantiferin TB Gold or T-Spiat TB, these are blood tests.
How do they work?
They measure how the patient's own T cells react when exposed to specific TB antigens in the lab. The key is these antigens are specific to Mycobacterium tuberculosis and are not found in the BCG vaccine.
Ah, so no false positives from BCG vaccination.
Correct. Much better specificity, especially in BCG vaccinated populations. They're also more convenient. Just one blood draw results in a day or so. No need for a return visit to read it.
Okay, so PPD or IgRA helps tell us about infection, latent or otherwise. What about confirming active contagious disease? Imaging.
Chest x-ray is usually the next step if you suspect active disease. We're looking for characteristic abnormalities in primary progressive TB, maybe enlarged lymph nodes or pleural effusions. In reactivation TB, the classic finding is infiltrates, often in the upper lobes of the lungs.
And those cavities?
Cavitary lesions, yes. These are basically holes in the lung tissue where the bacteria have eaten away at it. Seeing cavities strongly suggests active infectious TB. You might also see evidence of old healed infection, like those Gunnan complexes.
But the X-ray isn't definitive proof, is it? You need to find the actual bacteria.
Correct. The gold standard for confirming active pulmonary TB and determining infectiousness is examining the patient's sputum. We need sputum samples.
Looking for AFB.
Looking for acid fast bacilli, AFB. We do a special stain, the Seal-Nielsen stain or a fluorescent version. TB bacteria have that waxy cell wall that holds onto the stain even when washed with acid, so they appear bright red or fluorescent under the microscope. That's an AFB smear.
A positive smear means?
A positive AFB smear is highly indicative of active, potentially infectious TB, but the definitive diagnosis comes from culture, growing the actual Mycobacterium tuberculosis from the sputum sample.
But culture takes time, right? Weeks.
Weeks, yes. TB bacteria grow very slowly. So the smear gives us a rapid presumptive diagnosis and tells us if the patient is likely infectious right now, but culture confirms it and is essential for the next step.
Which is?
Drug susceptibility testing. We absolutely have to test the cultured bacteria to see which antibiotics will actually kill it.
Because of resistance.
Because of the alarming rise of drug-resistant TB globally. Starting standard treatment without knowing the susceptibility pattern is dangerous. If the patient has resistant TB, the standard drugs won't work, and you could actually make the resistance worse.
We need to talk about MDR-TB.
Yes. Multidrug-resistant TB, MDR-TB, is defined as resistance to at least the two most important first-line drugs, isoniazid, INH, and rifampin.
And it gets worse than that.
It does. There's also extensively drug-resistant TB, XDR-TB. That's MDR-TB plus resistance to any fluoroquinolone and at least one of the injectable second-line drugs. Treating these strains is incredibly difficult, takes much longer, uses more toxic drugs, and success rates are lower.
So that susceptibility test is absolutely critical before locking in a treatment plan.
Mandatory. Non-negotiable.
Okay, and one more crucial point related to the AFB smear. Getting patients off isolation. What's the rule?
This is a key safety point for nursing. To discontinue airborne isolation precautions, the patient needs to meet three criteria. One, they must be showing clinical improvement on treatment. Two, they need to have completed an appropriate initial course of therapy. And three, they must have three consecutive negative AFB sputum smears.
Three negatives. How far apart?
Collected 8 to 24 hours apart, with at least one being an early morning specimen, which is usually the most concentrated. Until you have those three confirmed negative smears, the patient is considered potentially infectious and isolation must continue. No exceptions.
Got it. That's a hard stop rule.
Yeah.
Okay, this sets us up perfectly for section 4, treatment and the absolutely critical role of nursing management. This is where the rubber meets the road for long-term success.
It really is, because TB treatment is long, it's complex, and adherence is everything.
Let's start with the standard treatment. What drugs are we using for typical drug-susceptible active TB?
We never, ever treat active TB with just one drug. That breeds resistance. It has to be combination therapy. The standard first-line regimen uses four drugs, often remembered by the acronym RIPE.
RIPE. Let's break that down.
Okay. R is for rifampin. I is for isoniazid, often called INH. P is for pyrazinamide, or PZA. And E is for ethambutol.
Four drugs. How long are they typically taken together?
Usually all four are given together for the initial phase, called the intensive phase. That typically lasts for the first 8 weeks or 2 months.
Okay, intensive phase, four drugs for 2 months, then what?
Then, assuming the bacteria are susceptible to INH and rifampin based on the susceptibility tests, treatment usually steps down to a continuation phase. This typically involves just INH and rifampin.
And how long does that continuation phase last? This is where the duration really adds up, right?
Exactly. The total duration of treatment for standard pulmonary TB is usually a minimum of 6 months. So 2 months of RIPE, followed by 4 months of INH and rifampin.
6 months minimum. Can it be longer?
Oh, yes. For certain types of TB, like TB involving the bone or brain, meningitis, or if the initial response is slow or if there were issues with adherence, treatment often needs to be extended to 9 or even 12 months. And for drug-resistant TB, we're talking 18 to 24 months or longer.
That duration, 6, 9, 12 months,
yeah.
That's a huge commitment for a patient. It immediately highlights the challenge of compliance.
It's the central challenge, taking multiple pills every single day for that long, especially when you start feeling better after a few weeks, is incredibly difficult.
Before we get into managing that, there's one other essential component of the initial regimen, particularly with INH, the supplement.
Yes, absolutely vital. Patients taking isoniazid must also take vitamin B6, which is pyridoxine.
Why B6?
Because INH can interfere with vitamin B6 metabolism, and a deficiency can lead to peripheral neuropathy, numbness, tingling, pain in the hands and feet. It can be quite severe and sometimes irreversible. Taking B6 prevents this major side effect. Nurses need to stress that the B6 is just as important as the antibiotics.
Good point. Now, these drugs aren't exactly gentle. Let's talk side effects. What are the major things nurses need to monitor for? Because side effects are a huge reason people stop taking their meds.
They are. And the list is pretty significant. Probably the most serious concern across several of the drugs, particularly INH and rifampin and also PZA, is hepatotoxicity, liver damage.
How do we monitor for that?
Regular blood tests are essential. Liver function tests, specifically AST and ALT, need to be checked at baseline before starting treatment, and then typically monthly throughout the entire course.
Monthly for 6 to 12 months?
At least monthly. Some guidelines suggest more frequently in the beginning or if risk factors are present. The nurse has a huge role in educating the patient about the signs and symptoms of liver injury, things like jaundice, yellowing skin or eyes, dark urine, abdominal pain, unusual fatigue, nausea, or vomiting. They need to report those immediately.
Okay, hepatotoxicity is number one. What else with rifampin? It has that colorful side effect.
Yes. Rifampin turns body fluids, urine, sweat, tears, saliva, a harmless reddish-orange color. It can stain contact lenses, clothing. It's completely benign. But if patients aren't warned, they can get really scared and stop the drug. So upfront education about the orange discoloration is crucial.
Good tip. What about PZA and ethambutol?
Pyrazinamide, PZA, can cause nausea and vomiting, and it can also increase uric acid levels, potentially triggering gout attacks in susceptible people. Ethambutol's main serious side effect is optic neuritis.
Affecting the eyes.
Yes. Inflammation of the optic nerve. It can cause blurred vision, difficulty distinguishing colors, especially red and green, and potentially vision loss. It's often dose-related and usually reversible if caught early and the drug is stopped.
So vision checks are needed.
Absolutely. Baseline vision assessment, including color vision testing before starting ethambutol, and then regular monitoring, asking about any changes in vision at every visit. Patients need to know to report visual symptoms right away.
Wow, that's a lot to track. Hepatotoxicity, neuropathy with INH unless B6 is given, orange fluids with rifampin, potential gout with PZA, and vision changes with ethambutol.
It underscores why nursing oversight is so intensive and continuous throughout TB treatment.
Okay, before we dive deeper into the nursing actions, let's quickly touch on prophylaxis again. Who gets preventive therapy? Usually just INH.
Right. Prophylactic therapy, often with INH alone for 6 or 9 months, or sometimes other regimens, is mainly for people with confirmed latent TB infection, a positive PPD or IGRA, who are at high risk of it progressing to active disease.
Like who specifically?
Close contacts of someone with infectious pulmonary TB, people with HIV, organ transplant recipients, people on TNF-alpha inhibitors for autoimmune diseases, patients with silicosis, those with chest x-ray findings suggesting old, healed TB. Basically, anyone whose immune system is compromised or likely to become compromised or had significant recent exposure. The goal is clear. Eliminate the dormant bacteria before they reactivate.
Makes sense. Okay, now the core. Nursing management. This is really about ensuring treatment success and safety. Let's break down the key nursing actions.
This is where nursing practice makes a massive difference.
First up, even though drugs are the main treatment, basic respiratory care is still important, right? Airway management.
Definitely. While the meds are killing the bacteria, we still need to help the lungs heal. That means promoting airway clearance. Simple things like ensuring adequate hydration, plenty of fluids to help thin respiratory secretions so they're easier to cough up.
Teaching effective coughing.
Yes, teaching directed coughing techniques. And sometimes, depending on the amount of secretions, postural drainage or chest physiotherapy might be beneficial to mobilize mucus. It helps prevent complications like secondary bacterial pneumonia and just makes the patient feel better faster.
Okay, airway clearance. Number two, and you've stressed this already, adherence monitoring. This seems like the biggest piece. How do nurses actually ensure patients take all these pills for so many months?
This is often the most challenging yet most critical aspect. Given the public health implications of treatment failure and developing resistance, the gold standard for ensuring adherence, especially in high-risk situations or with drug-resistant TB, is directly observed therapy, or DOT.
DOT. What does that involve?
It means a trained healthcare worker, often a public health nurse or an outreach worker, physically watches the patient swallow every single dose of their medication every day or several times a week, depending on the regimen.
Wow. That's resource intensive.
Incredibly resource intensive, but it's the most effective way we have to guarantee adherence and prevent the emergence of drug resistance caused by missed doses. It takes the guesswork out of it. Where DOT isn't feasible, nurses use pill counts, patient diaries, electronic monitoring devices, motivational interviewing, but DOT is the standard when stakes are high.
So the nurse's role becomes much broader than just giving meds. It's case management support.
Absolutely. It's building trust, identifying barriers to adherence like transportation, childcare, unstable housing, substance use issues, mental health comorbidities, and then working with the patient and other resources to overcome those barriers. It's part social work, part educator, part advocate.
Which ties into the third area, safety surveillance. We talked about the side effects and the need for monthly labs, liver function, etc. What's the nurse's action if those labs are abnormal or the patient reports symptoms?
The nurse is the first line of defense here. They're monitoring those lab results closely. If ESTALT levels start climbing significantly, indicating potential liver injury, the nurse needs to recognize that threshold, immediately notify the prescribing physician or provider.
All the drugs.
Potentially hold the hepatotoxic drugs based on standing orders or direct communication. Then reinforce education with the patient, stop alcohol, avoid acetaminophen, Tylenol, report worsening symptoms. Same for vision changes with ethambutol, immediate report, potential drug hold, pending ophthalmology consult. It's active surveillance and prompt intervention to prevent serious harm. Also, monitoring for drug interactions is key, especially with rifampin, which interacts with many medications.
Okay, fourth area, supporting recovery. Nutritional and activity support. TB takes a toll on the body.
It really does. TB is a catabolic illness. It breaks down body tissues. Patients often present malnourished and very weak. So nutritional support is vital. The nurse encourages a diet high in calories and protein to help rebuild strength, support the immune system, and promote healing.
Like supplemental shakes.
Sometimes, yes. Or just education on nutrient-dense foods. And activity needs to be managed carefully. Pushing too hard too soon can be counterproductive. It's about gradual increases in activity as tolerated, balancing rest and exercise to rebuild stamina without causing exhaustion.
Makes sense. Fifth point, patient education. Okay. This seems continuous, covering everything from preventing spread to sticking with treatment.
Education is constant. Early on, it's about infection control at home, covering the mouth and nose when coughing or sneezing, proper disposal of tissues into a closed bag, maybe limiting visitors initially, good ventilation. This continues until they are confirmed non-infectious by those negative smears.
And education about the disease and treatment itself.
Absolutely. Explaining why treatment is so long, why taking every dose is critical to prevent resistance, reinforcing the side effects to watch for, the importance of follow-up appointments and lab tests. Empowering the patient with knowledge is key to adherence. Education must emphasize that they need to complete the entire course, even after they feel perfectly well.
And the final nursing role you highlighted. The public health obligation.
Yes. Nurses are legally and ethically obligated to report every diagnosed case of active TB to the local or state public health department. This is not optional. It's mandatory.
Why is reporting so critical?
Because TB is a public health threat. Reporting triggers the public health system response. Contact investigation. Public health nurses will then identify people who are in close contact with the infectious patient during their contagious period.
Family members, coworkers.
Exactly. And these contacts will be screened for TB infection, latent or active, and offered preventative therapy if appropriate. This is how we break the chain of transmission in the community. The hospital nurse is the first link in that chain.
So that covers the core nursing actions. And the follow-up care reinforces the long-term nature of this. Monthly monitoring is standard.
Yes, even for patients treated entirely as outpatients after an initial diagnosis. That monthly check on liver function, AST, ALT, is standard practice due to the risk from INH, rifampin, PZA. Kidney function, BUN, creatinine, might also be monitored periodically, especially if there are comorbidities or other nephrotoxic drugs involved. It's about ensuring the treatment is not only working, but also safe. For the entire duration.
It's a marathon, not a sprint, for both the patient and the healthcare team, especially nursing. Okay, let's briefly touch on section 5, complications and context. If treatment fails or resistance is high, what are the really bad outcomes we can see?
Well, beyond the progression of lung destruction itself, failure can lead to some truly severe complications.
We mentioned miliary TB, the widespread disseminated form.
Yeah.
What else?
One of the most feared is TB meningitis. If the bacteria spread to the meninges, the membranes covering the brain and spinal cord, It's notoriously difficult to treat because many TB drugs don't penetrate the blood-brain barrier very well.
Outcomes are poor.
Often, yes. High risk of death or permanent neurological damage, seizures, stroke, cognitive impairment. Early diagnosis and aggressive treatment are critical but challenging.
And complications within the lungs themselves from the damage.
Oh, yeah. The cavitary lesions, those holes in the lungs, can erode into blood vessels, causing massive hemoptysis, coughing up large amounts of blood, which can be fatal. Severe lung destruction can lead to chronic respiratory failure, requiring long-term oxygen or even mechanical ventilation.
What about air leaks or fistulas?
Right. A cavity near the edge of the lung can rupture into the pleural space, the area between the lung and the chest wall. This causes a pneumothorax, collapsed lung. Sometimes a persistent abnormal connection can form between the airway, bronchus, and the pleural space, that's a bronchopleural fistula. These are very difficult to manage, often requiring chest tubes for long periods and sometimes complex surgery. You can also get TB pneumonia, where the infection fills the airspaces more diffusely.
So the stakes are incredibly high if treatment isn't successful. Which brings us back, one last time, to the core concept nurses need to grasp for clinical decisions.
It all boils down to distinguishing active disease from latent infection. Is the patient sick and contagious right now? That's active TB, needs isolation, needs full RAPE combination therapy, needs public health reporting and contact tracing. Or is the patient, well, not contagious, but carrying the dormant bacteria? That's latent TB, doesn't need isolation, needs consideration for preventative therapy only. Getting that distinction right drives all the immediate actions.
Absolutely critical. Okay, let's wrap this up in our outro. Key takeaways for the nursing students and clinicians listening.
All right, three big ones to hammer home. Compliance, control, and diagnostics.
Okay, number one, control. If you even suspect active TB, airborne isolation is immediate and mandatory. Don't wait. And that means using a properly fit-tested N95 respirator or a PPR for anyone entering the room until you have those three consecutive negative AFB smears confirming they're no longer infectious. Protect yourself, protect others.
Number two, diagnostics, specifically susceptibility. Assume resistance is possible until proven otherwise. Drug susceptibility testing on that first positive culture is non-negotiable before you get too far down the treatment path. Starting the wrong regimen is how we create MDR and XDR TB. Don't contribute to the problem.
And number three, the cornerstone, especially for nursing.
Medication compliance, adherence. That 6 to 12 month treatment duration is the biggest hurdle. Your role in ensuring adherence, whether through DOT, education, support, managing side effects, is probably the single most important factor in curing the patient, preventing relapse, and stopping the spread of drug resistance globally.
It really elevates the nurse's role beyond just administering medication to being the central figure managing a complex long-term public health intervention.
Exactly.
Which brings us to our final thought for you, the listener, to ponder.
We've hammered home that compliance, often through DOT, is key, but DOT itself faces huge challenges. Given that success hinges on patients sticking to these tough regimens for so long, what are the deeper systemic issues? Things like housing instability, food insecurity, lack of transportation, mental health support, the stigma surrounding TB that we as a healthcare system and society need to address to make long-term adherence truly achievable for everyone, especially the most vulnerable. How do we move beyond just watching someone take a pill?
That's a crucial question. The nursing role extends far beyond the clinic walls, deep into the patient's life and community challenges. It's a massive responsibility, requiring immense skill and compassion. Thank you for sharing the sources that let us take this deep dive into TB management today.
It's vital information. Stay vigilant, stay safe, and keep learning.